What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
The Future Proof Podcast from Newstalk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McCrae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating. We appreciate it as always. Coming up on this week's program, we're going to be talking about traumatic brain injuries. When you get a bang to the head, whether it's on a sports field or a battlefield, there's very little that can be done about it. And sometimes the effect of these injuries can go on for weeks, months, and be quite severe. Could brain training be a new therapy? We'll be finding out in a few minutes' time. But first, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And here to join us is Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen. You're both very welcome. Our first story. So this is a story about how music can be infectious.
Yeah, like a virus, in fact. And this is work from McMaster University in Ontario. And what they did is, it's an incredible story. They're mathematicians, and they looked at a database of 1.4 billion song downloads from a music streaming service called Mix Radio, which has subsequently disappeared. And they looked at the top 1,000 songs between 2007 and 2014. And they looked at how well a standard model of epidemic disease called SIR, how well that fitted the song download trends over time. And you know what? It fitted it really, really well. So they're suggesting that the same social processes, basically connections from one person to another, that allow for or model disease spread also models song spread. Of course, the difference being that when it comes to diseases, you have to have physical contact with someone, as we all know at the moment, for diseases to spread. But for songs, of course, you can have other forms of contact that can be virtual as well as physical. So it's not linked just to physical contacts. So it's fantastic. I love it. I'm a big fan of music and maths together. Of course, I run that Quavers Quadratics program in the concert hall. So I have a natural inclination towards these types of stories. But this is absolutely just brilliant. They calculated an R number for it. So that's the reproduction number that we're all so familiar with COVID. It's basically the ability of the disease to spread. And when they were calculating this, they looked at it assuming there was no immunity through infection, i.e. heard it before, or vaccination, as in like people just tell me that's really bad. My social group tell me that's bad music. And they found that there's a different R number for different types of music. I was surprised by this. Dance music and metal come in lowest with an R number of 2.8 and 3.7, respectively. Next up, we have pop and rock, and they're about 10 times bigger. But hip hop and electronic music are huge. Hip hop has an R number of 310. And electronic music has an R number of 3,430. Now, thankfully, COVID does not have an R number anything close to that. I don't think there'd be anyone left who hadn't had it. So, yeah, they say that electronic music has it's the most earwormy of music in this study. Now, I was very skeptical because I don't know about you guys, but I would consider electronic music to be sort of niche. Right. If you're into it, you're into it. But most people wouldn't say it's their number one genre of music. I would have thought pop would have been, just based on the fact that that's what most people listen to. I'm not saying it's the best music, just that's what people listen to. And this study sort of figures out why electronic music may have been so high in its R number. They say that there's a sort of a clique with it, and electronic music fans are just perhaps more passionate. And so when a new piece comes out, they're the type that are going to spread it on social media and between their networks. Hmm. And that's what leads to a rapid spread within electronic music. So there's already people talking about commercializing this. you could, in theory, use the epidemiology to model how long a song will be popular and thus how much money is it going to make?
Yeah. And were there songs that had amazing R numbers individually? Like songs that were just, they just blew up, like Carly Jepsen's Call Me Maybe?
They didn't get into that level of detail, right. But I'm hoping this is just the beginning, Jonathan, of a whole new area of maths and science together. I think it's great. You know, I love this sort of stuff. It's brilliant.
Brilliant. Our second story is a more serious subject, of course, COVID, but a rather unusual slant. Hope from llamas, Ruth.
Yes, it's nice to have a good news story on COVID at the moment. And this is really interesting work from a team in the UK who are looking at a new therapy for COVID, because while we're seeing great rollout of the vaccination, particularly here, but hopefully soon globally, there will still be people who will get COVID, people who can't get vaccinated. So we're probably going to need therapies for COVID for a long time to come. And this is work using llamas. And what's really fascinating about llamas, and this was discovered about 30 years ago, is that they don't produce the same kinds of antibodies as the rest of us. So they produce a version of an antibody, so these little things that float around in our blood and stick to viruses when they come into them, called a nanobody. And these nanobodies are much smaller than antibodies, and that gives them some special advantages. Because if you imagine, just their physical size is smaller, so they can get into all the cracks and grooves on a virus and stick really, really tightly to a virus. So the team in the UK, they had a clearly willing volunteer llama called Fifi. They injected Fifi with the now famous spike protein from SARS-CoV-2. And after she had developed an immune response, they extracted some of her blood and they purified four different nanobodies that stuck to the spike protein. They did a huge amount of work characterizing the structure, physical shape of those nanobodies. And they picked out the one that seemed to be most effective sticking to the virus. They made a little triplet of that. So they joined it together to make it even more effective. And they produced it in large quantities and treated some hamsters in the lab. So these hamsters have been, yeah.
Where did the hamsters come into it?
Well, apparently a Syrian hamster lab model is a very good lab model for human COVID-19 when infected with SARS-CoV-2. So they get very similar kind of respiratory responses. Right. And they found this was really, really positive. So the hamsters who were treated with these nanobodies recovered very, very quickly and had very low viral loads in their nasal tracts and their respiratory passages. So this is really, really exciting. This work only started about 6 months ago. So it's another example of science just working really, really fast during the pandemic. And, you know, human antibodies could be used for this kind of work, but they have to be extracted from patients who have had COVID-19, you know, and in fact, these nanobodies are likely to be more effective. They're more stable, they're cheaper to produce, and they could potentially be administered to people with a simple nasal spray.
How's Fifi doing now?
Great, apparently.
Okay, good. Our third story, Shane, is another line in the long story of quantum computing, apparently. What's happening now?
Yeah, this is another tech race, I suppose, that's built on the back of quantum physics. So this is a new record from the University of Science and Technology of China. And they have built a new quantum computer that has slightly more qubits than the previous best in class by Google called Sycamore. And the Chinese one, which is called Zhuchongqi, has done a calculation in 4.2 hours that would have taken a regular classical computer with, you know, just regular bits, hundreds of thousands of years. And it is just a step forward, but each step forward is important. Because as you add more qubits, that's the basic computational unit, to a quantum computer, getting the thing to work becomes getting the thing to work becomes far more complicated. It's not a case of one little bit extra means one little bit of work. It's a big leap with each new qubit. So Peter Knight from Imperial College London has suggested this is only the beginning. And he said there's a huge amount of investment coming from private sources here, from Google and from universities in China to get ahead. And like, because they can see the financial benefits of being able to produce quantum computers. I was interested in this as I wondered who beyond scientists would like these computers, because they're going to be very expensive. So we're not going to have quantum computers on our desks anytime soon. These are only going to be used by very rich organizations, such as car companies who are trying to understand fundamental atomic behavior in batteries so they can store energy, and also big pharma, who are trying to look at how drugs work on a computational level. And we covered this on the show before about the, I suppose, parallel processes that you can do on computers as well as in human trials in order to discover new medicines.
I know we have 5G coming around the corner, and finding applications that a real world application for that can sometimes be kind of tricky beyond the first three or four that come to mind. And so it's good that we have some idea of what to do with this amazing horsepower and what sort of problems we're going to tackle with it.
But build it and they will come. You know, the laser, I know it's the classic story. It was invented and hanging around for a long time before people found real good uses for it. Science has shown again and again, the fundamental science will turn into applications if there's funding for people to find those applications.
Mm. Ruth, our final story has to do with cheese.
Yes. So this is a new study that's come out looking at the impact of dairy, eating dairy, on the health of your heart. And of course, for many years, our dietary guidelines have been that, yes, it's good to eat dairy because it gives us important nutrients like calcium, but we should avoid the high fat versions of dairy. So things like cream and cheese and high fat yogurts and those kind of things. But a number of studies over the past decade or so have been challenging those assumptions. And this is a new, very large study from researchers in Australia, Sweden and the States. And they measured the dairy consumption in around just over 4,000 Swedish adults in their 60s. And then they followed those adults for around 17 years and they assessed how well they did in terms of their heart health. And what they found was that those the people who had the highest consumption of dairy, as measured by a single blood test at the beginning of the study, went on to have the best cardiovascular outcomes. So this is, you know, potentially not the greatest study. I was actually quite surprised at the amount of headlines that it got all over the place, because, you know, I think there's a number of issues with it, as there often are with these nutritional studies. But I think it does add to this growing set of evidence, which says we can't look at food as a sort of simple delivery vehicle of calories and isolated nutrients that sit in that food. Mm. You know, in fact, food is more complex than that. How different people react to different types of food is more complex. And there certainly seems to be benefits in dairy products. So we see some dairy products like yogurt are fermented. And I think we've talked about the benefits of fermented food before. There's things like vitamin K in cheeses. And there's also this idea of things like the matrix effect, which essentially looks at the actual structure of the food and how it travels through your digestive system. And again, because dairy is high in calcium, we may be able to digest it and get some of the nutrients out of it without absorbing all of the saturated fat.
Right. But this particular study, the level of evidence is not very high for the claims being made.
I think it's a bit weak. I mean, the group that had the lower levels of cardiovascular disease, but the highest inputs of dairy, also had lower BMIs, lower levels of smoking, higher levels of physical activity and education, higher levels of fruit and vegetable consumption. And while the scientists did try and control for those, and they also looked at other studies to see if they could find similar results, you know, I think it's very hard to unpick those correlations versus causation. Having said that, I think, you know, when, you know, in terms of the overall messaging here, there is no doubt that when we look at some saturated fats like that in meat and coconut oil, we're not seeing the same signals that we're seeing around dairy. So I think there is more to unpick in the dairy story, and we just need to be a little bit careful with broad claims about any one group of foods or a big mega group of foods in nutrition. And again, the kind of the boring punchline with all these stories is varied diet, moderation, lots of fruit and veg, less processed food. I mean, that kind of message isn't changing. So you know, we do have some certainty around the kind of science of nutrition.
Well, thanks very much. That's sort of a complex issue, excellently handled. Thanks very much, Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland. And as always, from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen, thanks very much. Now, before we go into our feature, just to let you know that the FameLab Ireland final is happening on the 30th of September. That's this Thursday night. If you want to get tickets, all you have to do is log on to britishcouncil.ie/FameLab. It is a science communication competition. We've been partners for many years. This is the final year, and so it should be a great night. Lots of young scientists talking about interesting ideas in an engaging way in just 3 minutes. I guarantee you'll enjoy it as a night in. Check it out, britishcouncil.ie/FameLab. Now, mild traumatic brain injuries affect the lives of thousands of people every year, with rehabilitation lasting anything between a few days to a number of months to sometimes years. And despite the growing awareness of the damage these injuries can have on a person's life, we still haven't quite cracked the therapies. But could a new spin on brain training make the difference? Well, Dr. Henry Manka is CEO of Posit Science, who joins me now. Perhaps you might start off talking about the BRAVE study, Henry. What was that and what was it trying to achieve?
Yeah, so what the BRAVE study was a classic gold standard clinical trial, and was funded by the United States Department of Defense. And the reason they asked for this trial is they were looking for new treatments for mild traumatic brain injury. And of course, the reason they wanted this is, you know, the terrible problem we've had here in the States, and of course, at many NATO countries, of service members coming back from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan with, you know, long-term consequences of MTBI. And it's really changed our thinking, I think, in neuroscience about these kinds of injuries.
Before you go on, Henry, what sort of injuries are we talking about? Do you have to have a trauma to the head, or could it be something less serious? What's typically the sort of injuries that cause these injuries on the brain?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. And the phrase mild traumatic brain injury is unto itself a conundrum, because on the one hand, it's called mild, but they're very serious results. On the other hand, it's called a traumatic brain injury. A lot of people think that means, you know, maybe your skull's been cracked open. So what we're talking about here is an injury to the brain where the head has stayed intact, but the brain itself has been shaken and damaged in some sense. And it can come from all kinds of things. Like in civilian life, you know, we would call it a concussion, right? And it could be as simple as you tripped and fall and bumped your head, right? You know, that is a concussion. Concussions happen in sports, of course, as you know, in Ireland from rugby, and here in the United States from American football. And in the military, particularly in these wars, what has happened is that we have service members who are experiencing many, many MTBIs or concussions. So for example, a roadside improvised explosive device, an IED, you're driving by just on the road in your Jeep and a bomb goes off, you're thrown from your Jeep. And, you know, while you may recover physically, you know, within a day, you know, your brain has had that huge blast wave pass through it and been shaken about. And of course, in these wars, what's happened is we've had service members who experienced not one, not two, not three of these, you know, concussive events, but, you know, dozens or in many cases, hundreds. Wow. And what it's given us an appreciation for is that while in many cases, if you have a single event like this and you're young and healthy, you fall down and you whack your head, you're going to bounce back fine. You're not going to have any problems, you know, in most cases. But when you have this accumulation of many of these events, you know, it's not uncommon to have a very different outcome, where people come back and hey, they have sleep problems, they have headaches, they have mood problems, they have depressive symptoms, and in many cases, they have cognitive impairment. They report problems with thinking and memory and concentration.
Yeah.
And what led to the BRAVE study was the Department of Defense looking at these service members and wanting them to go back to service to, you know, keep doing the important work they do, or reintegrate with civilian life after they were discharged from service, going back to school, getting a job, you know, playing an important role in their family as parents or as spouses or as caregivers. And the Department of Defense said, hey, what can we do to help more of these people? Because we have these problems and there's no drugs that have been approved. You know, there aren't really good therapies. We need something new. And that led to the BRAVE study.
So what was the methodology? What were you trying out, and what was the hypothesis?
Yeah, so I work at a company called Posit Science, and what we've been doing is building brain training programs that are built on the idea of brain plasticity. So what do I mean by brain plasticity? Well, you know, if you were to wind the clock back to, let's say, 1970, and you were asked any brain scientist, how does the brain work? Every one of them would have said the same thing. They would have said the brain is like a computer chip inside your head, right? It's made up of wires, the wires, you know, use electricity, the whole thing processes information, feels like a computer chip. And that metaphor, you know, that was an important metaphor, but it did lead to some problematic thinking. And in particular, if you think of the brain like a computer chip, you're naturally going to think, well, look, if it gets bumped, if those wires get broken, you know, you're not going to fix it, right? We've all had the experience of dropping our computer, like, well, I guess I need a new computer, don't I? And that led to this thinking about the brain where we thought that, hey, brain damage, even mild traumatic brain injury, probably not going to rewire yourself and get better from that. Now, the single most important thing I could talk about during our entire chat here, Jonathan, that I hope your listeners walk away with from is nobody believes that anymore. The brain is not at all like a computer chip inside your head. And in fact, the brain is an organic system that is constantly rewiring and rebuilding itself in response to what we do with it, our experience and our learning. And this happens when we're kids. It happens when we're young adults. It happens when we're older adults. It happens when we have healthy brains. It happens when we have brains that aren't so healthy. It's a fundamental operating principle of the brain that it's always rebuilding itself. And that's what we mean by the phrase brain plasticity.
Okay, so take me through the trial. 80 participants, some playing computer games and others playing tailored and specific brain training tasks that you had developed. What was different about your tasks to what most people would imagine is quite a good brain training thing? You know, computer games require agility, hand-eye coordination, spatial awareness, reflexes, and so on. So what was different about that your therapy that you were testing in the trial?
That's a great question. Our brain training exercises focus intensively on the speed and accuracy of information processing. We want to make information flow through your brain more quickly and more accurately. And so to do that, we build exercises that train that very specifically. So for example, you might, this is a radio show. Let's talk about an exercise that involves hearing, right? One of the exercises makes your auditory system faster and more accurate. And to do that, you hear these short whistles. So you might hear a little whistle like this. Let's see if I did that right. It kind of goes up. Or you might hear a whistle like this. It goes down. And so you hear a pair of them. They go, one might go up and one might go down. Like, now, if I do that slowly, well, it's pretty easy. Okay, the first one went up and the second one went down. But now imagine when you get that right, I make them a little bit faster. And I'm not going to try and whistle faster. I probably can't. That's why we use a computer. So they get faster and they get closer together. Now, if you have a sharp, accurate brain, because you're 23 years old, you're at the top of your game, no problem. You can hear those very quickly and accurately, even when they're fast and closer together. But if you have a brain that's suffering this noisiness, right, your brain is slower, it's less accurate. Pretty quickly, what happens is maybe you heard the two whistles, but you just can't figure out which one came first. Maybe you don't even hear two whistles. You just hear the first one and you're like, you know, doc, I didn't hear a second one. What happened there? All that's happening because the neural processing kind of overlaps itself in time. You're not done processing the first one before the second one comes in. So that's fine. Some people are good and some people are bad, but how can we make the people who are bad at that better? Well, we turn it into a training exercise. We start off with these big, loud whistles that are far apart. Anyone can do them right. And every time you get it right, well, we're a little bit devilish. We make it a little bit harder. We make those sounds faster and closer together. But if you get one wrong, it backs off, gets a little bit easier. And so it finds your right threshold. And that's the level at which we can drive brain change. When your brain is working hard, getting most of them right, but a few of them wrong, that's when your brain reorganizes itself to do right, better as a result of your attention and your reward. So all the exercises in Brain HQ are kind of variants of that simple idea. Whereas if you look at ordinary brain games, you know, they might involve attention, they might involve memory, memory, right? Think about playing Monopoly, right? You have to keep track of stuff, I guess, right? You have to pay attention, but you're not really making your brain faster and more accurate. Or think about crossword puzzles, right? People ask me all the time, are crossword puzzles good for the brain? I wish they were, right? A lot of people do crossword puzzles. But what the science shows us, unfortunately, is that, you know, people who have better cognitive function do more crossword puzzles, I guess, because they like them more, but they don't really change, you know, your average cognitive ability over time. Huh. So the brain games we use as the control were all things like that. They keep your brain busy. They seem like they might be good for your brain, but they're not making you faster and more accurate.
So what did you find in these various types of sets of training techniques? I mean, obviously, you imagine people will be able to identify those sounds better, but are they able to identify sounds generally better, or are they able to understand sounds? What was the outcome of
these tests? The classic question of brain training, you know, hey, I'm going to get better at hearing those sounds, you know, I hope, right? But am I going to get better at other cognitive tasks as well? So to answer that question, in the BRAVE study, you know, everyone who comes into the study gets a baseline cognitive assessment, a cognitive assessment after their training program, whether it's the intervention or the control. And then they actually get a third cognitive assessment 3 months later with no further training to see how the benefits held up. And the cognitive assessments are standardized tests that a neuropsychologist would use that aren't really that related to the training exercises. So for example, you get a memory test, right? I read you a list of 15 words and you tell me how many you say how many you can remember. Maybe you can remember three, maybe you can remember eight. And, you know, we see if that improves. You know, many, many tasks like that, that measure learning and memory and attention and executive function. And you might ask, so why would hearing those whistles faster improve your ability to remember a list of 15 words? Well, the answer is that by working on those whistling sounds, your auditory system is faster and more accurate. We've driven that background noise out of your auditory system. So now when the psychologist reads those 15 words, before you do the training, you have that background noise. Maybe you can only remember four or five. After the training, we've cleaned up that background noise. You can hear the words that the tester is saying more clearly and accurately, and you remember more of them. So that's what we call generalization, right? We want to see improvement in tasks that you didn't train at to see that the training has benefit. And then, of course, that's exactly what we saw in BRAVE. What we saw in BRAVE is that the people who went through these specialized brain training exercises, they improved their cognitive performance, well, by quite a lot, really. It's kind of like if you had people who were at the 50th percentile, who had, let's say, average cognitive performance, and you move them to the 74th percentile. So they improved a pretty meaningful amount. And the folks who did the brain games, they did the same number of hours of training, you know, they worked out their brains. They actually showed little to no improvement on those tests whatsoever.
What about the brains themselves? I mean, the noise you speak of, is that something you can record from the brain? Is it possible to image these connections and show the material difference in performance?
Yeah, absolutely. We did not have the opportunity to do that in the BRAVE study just because of how the funding of the study worked out. But other studies have looked at that question exactly. So there have been studies in older adults who also have kind of noisy brains as we all get older. And they've used functional magnetic resonance imaging, which, as you probably know, puts you inside of a magnet. And in particular, what they did was they asked the question in those studies, you know, how strong are the connections between different regions of the brain, which you can image with fMRI? And what they showed is that, you know, these kinds of brain exercises improved what's called functional connectivity. They improved the average level of the connection strength, but across a couple of different important brain networks, like the central executive network. It suggests that this training, by improving speed and accuracy, is helping these distinct regions of the brain talk to each other more efficiently.
What does this teach us about our brains, and what doors does it open for future research?
One of the most interesting and challenging things about working in this area is convincing people that that their brains can change. You know, something about the history and the culture that we have around brains. You know, people feel like I have the brain that my genetics gives me, right? Whatever my parents, you know, gave me, that's the brain I'm going to have. And, you know, we don't have that vision about the body, right? All of us know that, you know, how we exercise and what we eat, you know, we're going to have very, very different bodily health as a result of that. And you know, in fact, we feel guilty about it, right? I didn't exercise today. I ate too many burgers last night. It's going to be bad for me. So we have that sense that our physical health and condition is under our control, but we haven't yet built the idea that our cognitive health and condition is under our control. And that's led to this real kind of passivity about it, right? We think, well, as we get older, I'll retire. Maybe I'll watch some TV and, you know, I don't know, maybe my brain will keep working and maybe not, not really under my control. We have the sense in this case, coming back from the war, well, you know, you have the brain you have, you know, time to go back to school, friend, right? Time to go be at a job. And I think that what's exciting about this research is that it really, and here I have to get up on a bit of a soapbox, Jonathan, you know, what it really shows us is that our cognitive performance, our brain health is something that can be under our control. And it's kind of like we're exiting the dark ages, right? You know, I think as a result of other studies, and there are many at this point like this in many different health conditions, you know, we're going to look back on this age and we're not going to believe we just let people got old and not take care of their brains, right? We're not going to believe we had service people come and back from the war and we didn't do anything to help their brains. We're not going to believe we had people with severe mental illness and all we did was give them pills. We didn't do anything to help reorganize their brains. And that's what makes me, you know, really excited and hopeful about the future of this is kind of that change of, okay, let's take care of our brains. Let's work on optimizing our brain performance and our cognitive performance.
Really interesting stuff. Dr. Henry Monca, CEO of Posit Science. Thanks very much for your time.
Yeah, I should probably add that, you know, these exercises are available at brainhq.com. If anyone wants to try them, they can go and register and try free exercises to see if they like them. And if they're through them at worldwideweb.brainhq.com. Thank you for the conversation. It's been fun.
Thanks a lot, Henry. I have to say, I've been sort of a bit put off by some of the stories around brain training. So I wasn't sure what to make of the story. So what we do, just to let you know what goes on behind the scenes sometimes, what we do sometimes at the program is we send these stories to people we know and trust who have a good understanding of neuroscience, for example, just to see if the science stands up, because I'm not a neuroscientist. And so I it's harder for me to be able to tell the difference between good quality studies and bad. Sometimes it's obvious, but sometimes it is less so. And so we threw this to one of the people that we trust, and they said, look, these are good people. So potentially very interesting idea, using brain training to help the brain recover from traumatic brain injury. All right, well, this is usually the part of the podcast where we really go back to visit some of your comments and emails, science@newstalk.com, if you have a comment on what we've been talking about. But this week, none of your comments made a lot of sense to me, to be honest. And maybe that's because I've been drinking too much, or maybe it's because you think you are more lucid than you are, but we'll just skip this part for this week's podcast and hope that you're more coherent next week. Just a lot of babbling. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, who's producing, Simon Keeman, who's researching, Garrett Mulhall, and of course, Steve McClune is on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof on Tuesday in your podcast feed. Until then, have a great week and stay curious.